Case number 12-3050. United States of America versus Alfonso Martinez Cruz, appellant. Mr. Gilbert for the appellant, Mr. Coleman for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Richard Gilbert. I was the trial counsel for Mr. Martinez Cruz below. And if the court's questioning permits, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I believe that there are three basic facts that set up the legal issues that I believe this court has to decide. Those three facts are, one, Mr. Martinez Cruz did not have a lawyer in his Georgia conviction. Secondly, the only evidence of a waiver of that right is a signed form, written form in Spanish, signed by Mr. Cruz. And third, that Mr. Cruz, at the time he signed that, could not have read it because he was illiterate in Spanish. Therefore, it is our contention that the conviction in Georgia would not be constitutionally valid unless he had been verbally advised of his rights and waived them. Therefore, the legal issue, I believe, that's presented by the court is what burden the defendant has in this case. And I think this is a case where the difference between the burden of production and the burden of persuasion is significant. I think that Mr.
On the form, there is that notation of translation services as well, right? So that is a fact that we probably need to have in the mix, too.
Well, the problem is, of course, we don't know what that means.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about how things actually happen in courts. All right, and what happens in this courthouse every day? Somebody obviously ascertained that Mr. Martinez Cruz spoke Spanish because the waiver form tendered to him was in Spanish. Once somebody discovered that we had a defendant who spoke Spanish, it would be incumbent upon the court system to provide an interpreter to interpret what happened in open court. That's what interpreters do in this courthouse. It's a far different thing to say that it would have been the responsibility of the interpreter to have, and this is why I divided it between what happened before the plea and what might have happened during the plea. It is very unlikely that it would have been the responsibility of an interpreter to take Mr. Martinez Cruz aside and personally read to him and conceivably explain to him, since it is a complicated form, what the form said, since he couldn't read it. And so while I'm confident that someone interpreted whatever the judge said to him, it does not mean that someone read him the form and discussed it with him. So I think then the question really becomes, all right, what can we infer about what happened in the courtroom during the plea? And it's our argument that we don't know. That's why the burden of persuasion is so critical in this case. But there are certainly inferences that what Mr. Martinez Cruz was not actually advised by the judge and presumably translated, if the judge had advised him, about his rights. Why do I say that? And there are inferences, and they're not proof. But first of all, as I noted, the form was not corrected to show that the form had been read to him as opposed to that he read it. If you look actually at the plea documents in our case, we made it very clear that we crossed out "I have read" and we said "I have read to me." And that's the appropriate thing to do if you have an illiterate defendant. Secondly, it's the language of the judge that he signs, and it's a form, but he's signing it saying, "I've discussed the form, not the rights contained thereon. I've discussed the form with those assembled for arraignment." And I think two inferences can be drawn from that. It's not proof. I recognize that. That's why the ultimate burden is important. But the inferences that can be drawn from that is very much like what happens every day in this courthouse. The judges don't read the entire proffer of facts for any guilty plea. They don't read the entire plea agreement. They may ask counsel or they may summarize the important parts, but they don't read the whole thing, but they turn to the defendant and say, "Have you signed this paper? Is this your signature on this document? Did you understand it? Did you discuss it with your lawyer?" And so discussing the form simply could have been, and most likely I suggest was, since it's a very long form, it would take a lot of time to read it, most likely was, "Here's a form, it's got your signature on it. Is this your signature?" With respect to those assembled in a group, again, we know that misdemeanor courts in our states are under a great deal of pressure. It's reasonable. We do not assume, other than for the illiteracy issue, we do not assume there was anything improper with the judge getting everybody who's going to plead that day to these types of charges and having them sort of go through the plea colloquy with them all at once. And so I think that's the realistic inference from that form. I concede that it is not proof, and that's why the question becomes, who has the burden? Does Mr. Martinez-Cruz actually have to prove that no one verbally advised him? If that's the case, I concede he cannot do it without a transcript.
The burden question, are we filling a gap in the guidelines? I mean, the guidelines seem to suggest that there has to be some other source of law, and the only other source of law I think relevant here is the Due Process Clause, and then you're into interpreting Park versus Raley, which seems to imply, although I agree it doesn't hold, but seems to imply that putting the full burden on the defendant in these kinds of circumstances would be okay. So that's what I want you to respond to.
Well, I actually, of course, relied on that case because it talks about at least putting a burden of production on the defendant. And in our view, quite frankly, that language actually supports the argument that in this case there should be a difference. But I think that
My point about Park was it talks about the various practices around the country and seems to describe them as indicating there are different approaches to this, none of which is, no higher one of which is mandated by the Due Process Clause. And one of the approaches adopted by many courts, according to the Supreme Court, is to put the burden on the defendant in these circumstances.
Well, but it depends on what the burden is. And let me just suggest that I think that you, in ascertaining where
I've talked about the burden of proof in part.
Yes. Yeah. But I don't think there is any question that the issues raised by the affidavit, the fact of his illiteracy, the inferences from this form, at least meet the burden of production.
Well,
there is an issue.
That's so clear. If that meets the burden of production, then it would seem that the burden of production can always be met where the defendant testifies, offers an affidavit, saying that despite, as far as appears, apparent regularity, things were indeed not regular.
Well, I think you raise a very good question as to whether the affidavit alone could do that. I think certainly the cases that criticize defendants for failing to even make that basic representation themselves tend to argue that, yes, just saying it didn't happen, as long as there's nothing that contradicts it. And I think that's important. There's nothing that contradicts what Mr. Martinez-Cruz says happened. What the government seeks to do is to say, look, the presumption of regularity goes farther, and it actually means you can't presume that he was verbally advised of his rights and therefore waived them, notwithstanding the fact there's no evidence of that.
Aren't you really saying that, taking your assumption, this does meet the burden of production? The burden of production is always met unless, I guess, the paper record so clearly pinned down that in order to show a defect, the defendant has to explicitly contradict it.
Well, I think the way that I would answer that in this case is, let's suppose Mr. Martinez-Cruz had a degree from a Mexican university, and he was nonetheless arguing that, well, I couldn't read and write. Suppose the pre-sentence report said he had a higher education. Well, and, you know, that's
exceptional hypo, which does drive a hole in my hypo.
But the evidence here is that he could not read that form.
Yes.
So you really have to go farther than the form, and you have to somehow find...
The evidence is that we have an interpreter on hand for the event.
Who undoubtedly interpreted what the judge said to him. But that does not mean the interpreter said more than the judge said to him in open court. I mean, that's just not the way interpreters work.
Well, what about interpreting the form? Well, the form's in Spanish, but describing the form and describing what the judge said together?
I can't imagine, I don't know, we don't know what happened, of course, but I cannot imagine, I represent a lot of clients who speak Spanish, and when they have interpreters, they do not take it upon themselves to start translating or explaining documents. That's what the lawyers are for. I can't imagine the interpreter in this case would have taken Mr. Martinez-Cruz aside and gone over that form with him. She might have interpreted whatever the judge said, but she would not have gone over that form with him separately.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Nick Coleman for the United States. The district court correctly held that appellant...
Can you pull that microphone back up again? You pushed it down.
My apologies, Your Honor. The district court correctly held that appellant and not the government had the burden of proof that his prior conviction was constitutionally invalid. Every circuit to have addressed this question has held that it is the defendant and not the government who has that burden, and we believe that this court should so hold.
Did any of those circuits address the distinction, address the possible distinction between the process involved in a habeas effort to set aside a conviction and the process that might be involved where a prior conviction is used to increase the penalty on someone who's got in trouble again?
I'm not sure. I don't recall any case drawing a specific distinction. The cases which we've cited in our brief dealt with the particular question we have at hand, which is, in other words, the use of a prior conviction to enhance or potentially increase the sentence at the new proceeding, as opposed to a habeas proceeding, which is a challenge to the conviction itself.
Those opinions disregard the distinction that I mentioned raises some problem as to their persuasiveness. And the most they can be is persuasive to us.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because they were considering the exact... Well, obviously they're persuasive because they don't bind this court, but I think in all of those cases which we've cited, the circuits were addressing this question before this court. And so I think
that... question without regard to the distinction that I raised.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
That's all I'm extracting from.
Okay. Yes, they didn't try to draw a distinction or address whether there be a different standard with respect to a formal habeas proceeding attacking the conviction itself. I think the question of whether or not appellant can meet simply a burden of production. If you have the burden of proof on a question, the mere fact that you introduce some evidence in support of trying to establish facts showing that you've met your burden doesn't then shift the burden back to the other side. You don't just get to put some evidence on and then say, well, now it's the other side that must disprove. They have the affirmative burden to disprove
well,
whatever I've said.
The whole idea of there being separate burdens
yes.
presupposes that a certain number of instances precisely that scenario happens.
There are some legal issues where that is the case. We are not aware of any court or certainly of any federal court that has held that system is what should apply here. Here, the government met its burden of showing that there was, in fact, a prior conviction, and that fact was not contested. Appellant has the burden of showing that prior conviction should not be counted because it was unconstitutional. And he's conceded that he has not, if he has that burden of proving it, he has not done so. He certainly hasn't done so by a preponderance of the evidence, as Judge Hogan described appellant's burden. In this case,
it goes further because then the defendant says, well, it was uncounseled. Okay, well, then it wouldn't count. And then you come back and say, well, but they waived the right to counsel. And the defendant comes back and says, but it wasn't a knowing waiver. So we're about three more steps down the line from on the burden question. And you could imagine having different burdens depending on where the case draws the line.
I think actually it's just one question. And I think United States v. Dominguez from the Ninth Circuit, which we've cited in our brief, shows it's just one question. There, appellant also said, they the Ninth Circuit was addressing a situation like this where there was a prior conviction. There, in fact, was no evidence at all, as far as I can tell from reading that case, either way, as to whether or not the defendant had, in fact, waived his prior right to counsel. And the Ninth Circuit held that the district court erred in assigning to the government the burden of showing that the defendant had validly waived counsel.
Well, isn't that consistent with the burden of production viewpoint?
No, I don't think it is. I think, again, because there, you know, it was just shown. Everybody knew that the defendant had no counsel. And beyond that, there was no further facts.
You come in with a fairly strong presumption of regularity expressed in Park, and there's nothing drawing in question regularity, and is any burden of production, God hasn't met it.
And I think that's correct. And I think because of the presumption of regularity, the burden-shifting scheme that appellant is proposing here would eviscerate that presumption of regularity, because what it would say is essentially that as long as the defendant puts on his own claims about what happened in the proceeding.
That partly depends upon what's needed to satisfy the
burden of
production, right? Which in a sense has not been clearly disputed.
Well, yes, I think that's certainly the case. I don't think, however, that one needs to address it by a sort of ritual dance where if some evidence comes in, now the burden shifts back to the government, and then it would shift back again if the government produces the waiver form, as happened in this case. I think again, there's one question which I think the court had to answer, which is, was the prior conviction constitutionally invalid? On that question, the defendant had the burden of proving that by the preponderance of the evidence, and he did not do so on this record.
What source of law are we drawing on in reaching the decision here? Because the guidelines obviously don't speak to this issue, and the commentary suggests that it has to be found in some other source of law. I've assumed that, therefore, what we're doing is taking the floor established by the Due Process Clause.
I think that's absolutely correct. The guidelines themselves, when they used to speak to this, when they contemplated authorizing challenges to prior convictions at all, said that the burden was on the defendant. That's how it was phrased. And then they were amended to say that the guidelines themselves were not supposed to independently, in and of themselves, authorize challenges to prior convictions. In other words, they left it to whatever the constitutional minimum was. And I think what Park v. Raley shows, and I think strongly suggests, is that the burden can be put upon the defendant. I mean, as the Supreme Court said in that case, there where it was pretty clear that it was not going to be possible to find much out about the prior state proceeding, and there the defendant had argued that it was going to be very difficult for him to prove that the prior conviction was constitutionally invalid, but the Supreme Court said, look, the government isn't necessarily in any better position than the defense to find that out. And in fact, the defendant is better positioned because, after all, he was there, unlike the government.
Well, what more is he supposed to say? The other side has said if they have to have a transcript, they lose because they don't have a transcript. So we understand that's their only concession, as far as I can understand. I'm really not following you on the burden of proof and burden of production. It seems kind of gobbledygook to me. As Judge Williams said, we often go back and forth in these cases. It is the norm. It is not an oddity where one side says, I win. If you don't say anything more, I've made my case. And they've essentially said, the affidavit is here. I've showed you. I've asserted, if the affidavit is good evidence, that I was uncounseled, and there was an unknowing waiver, and that's unconstitutional. Now, that's proof.
Well, I think the distinction is this. Once you have a question before the court and you know who has the burden of proof, now the court, the district court in this case, can look at the evidence that's presented and can decide, has appellant met his burden of proving?
Well, what I'm asking you, I've heard you say that many times, but there is proof. We're not focusing on the proof.
Well, right.
And I'm trying to understand, yes, what is it about the proof that he's offered that you find deficient? Are you just saying, well, no matter what a defendant offers, you just circle back to the presumption of regularity and they always lose?
No.
Because he did offer proof. He said, I was illiterate. He couldn't speak English. The translator did not translate anything on the form for him. This is all in the affidavit. I was not counsel. The judge's instructions to me were very limited, and there's nothing to indicate, I'm saying, I did not consciously waive my rights. Now, what more is he supposed to say?
The district court, I think, addressed those questions, Your Honor, in its ruling here. The district court looked at his affidavit and made a couple of findings about it. First of all, of course, it was self-serving, and that is something which the court could take
into
account.
But nevertheless, who's in court asserting the truth of the matter as they see it. It's really interesting to me that parties on the other side say, well, it's self-serving. Well, of course it is. He's essentially the plaintiff, so to speak. So, it's self-serving. Is he going to come in and say, hey, I should lose?
If I may, that is one point. And as I said, that's not the only thing which the district court said about the affidavit. The other problem with the affidavit was that appellant basically said, he actually says in the affidavit, I don't recall appearing before the judge.
Right.
And I don't even recall whether there was an interpreter. But I'm sure that nobody explained this form to me. Now, part of the problem, and I think as the district court pointed out and as the government
as Judge Hogan did.
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
So, I mean, is kind of an informed assertion. He said, I know it when I see it, and I don't recall ever seeing it down in Georgia. I did see it with Judge Hogan.
Right. One of the problems, though, with the affidavit is that on its face, you would think that the two facts that would stick out most in your mind, particularly for someone like appellant who, you know, as far as we can tell, it's true that appearance in Gwinnett County, Georgia, was his first appearance before the criminal justice system. You'd think that the two basic facts that you would remember for sure, did you appear in front of a judge, and was there somebody interpreting the proceedings for you into your own language? Because after all, if you never appeared before a judge, or if the entire proceedings were conducted in a language that you didn't understand at all, you'd be able to affirmatively say, one way or the other, about that.
Have you ever been to a court in Gwinnett, Georgia?
I haven't been to one in Gwinnett, Georgia.
What you're saying is accurate, because I have been in some state courts, and I think I could say, as did the defendant, I'm not sure who I was appearing before.
Well, I think
it's not an oddity. Unless we know something more about that court, I've seen state courts, and sometimes the chaos is quite beyond belief.
And that's
you're not
why
sure who it is you're talking to, or what their role is, or what you were just told.
The presumption of regularity,
that's what I said. You're circling back to the presumption of regularity. What would be a winning case in the affidavit for him?
He could never win. No, I don't think that's the case. If the district court were to look at a defendant's testimony, whether in affidavit form or otherwise, and say, I credit this defendant, what he's saying makes sense to me, then the district court could hold.
So read this affidavit and say, makes sense to us, you lose?
Well, I think the district court, in the first instance, is allowed to make the factual finding, and this court reviews it for clear error. And I don't think that it can be said that Judge Hogan committed clear error in looking at this record. And, of course, it's not just the affidavits that he had in front of him. The government also produced significant documentary evidence to suggest, contrary to what he had initially claimed in his first affidavit, that, in fact, he did waive his right to counsel, that, in fact, that there was an interpreter present. In other words, things that would show that the presumption of regularity was, in fact, borne out in this case.
The appearance of the translator, you can assume that, but that doesn't tell you much other than a translator was there.
Well, I think, again,
you're circling back to the presumption of regularity. And you're suggesting, unfairly, that if we try and guess too much at this level, we're asking for trouble. I understand your argument, but you certainly can't say anything more about the notation that there was a translator. It doesn't tell us anything more than maybe there was a translator around. That's all.
Well,
he suggests the translator did nothing with respect to this issue as far as he was concerned.
As far as I can tell, what he's really asking for is almost a presumption of irregularity. In other words, that we should assume, in the absence of contrary evidence, that what the Gwinnett County, Georgia courts do when they have Spanish-speaking defendants is they don't They don't make sure that they understand what's going on. They don't actually try to find out if they're waiving their right to counsel.
The problem is not the Spanish-speaking. The problem is the illiteracy.
Right.
Well, right, and of course,
because if it was just Spanish-speaking, well, the form is in Spanish. So they accommodated that and took care of that. Right. The question is whether the form was understood.
Well, the assumption, I think, is also being made here that the Gwinn County judge was so cavalier in addressing these that instead of asking not just did you sign this form, but did you understand it? Do you have any questions about it? I have to say I never saw a plea proceeding myself, and granted, I did not practice in Gwinn County, Georgia. But I never saw a plea proceeding where a judge didn't ask the question about a document in front of him. Did you understand it? Do you have questions? I can only, obviously, there are many different jurisdictions out there, and one lawyer can only be in
so many. And I don't mean to malign any, but there are a lot of things that go on that might, maybe you've been too closed in. You might be.
That's quite possible. But nevertheless, I think, though, that to assume that simply because in this other state we don't know enough about their proceedings, that they must have been violating, essentially violating the Constitution by not making sure that somebody was knowingly and intelligently waiving their right to counsel, I think it certainly is contrary to the presumption of regularity that the Supreme Court says courts should apply.
No, I think in fairness to them and in fairness to the assertions here, I think the suggestion is sometimes courts, because they're busy, may move too fast and assume things that are not accurate, as it turns out. Indeed, there was no translation. Indeed, this is an illiterate person before me, cannot read the Spanish on that form. And indeed, the translator really did nothing to assist the person. That could be the scenario. And you're right in saying, well, maybe so, but if there's a burden of proof of some sort, he hasn't shown it. Maybe.
I think that's correct. It's always possible that bad things can happen during prior proceedings. We certainly don't have what we have in terms of actual evidence before this court, and that was before the district judge, was documentary evidence that he did waive his right to counsel. And documentary evidence that there were translation services provided. That's
available.
The record which we have.
Available.
At least available. Yeah. I mean, the fact that he was assessed a fee would suggest that something was provided. And also, if he's saying, as he claims, he says, I only speak Spanish, I do not speak English. If so, it's hard to see how he could have done anything or communicated with the court in any way unless somebody was interpreting it. Because after all, he wouldn't have been able to answer the judge in English. So I think we have to assume that at least some interpretation was provided, because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to communicate, unless we are to assume that the judge convicted him without hearing from him or understanding a word that he said.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I think, in all honesty, you may win on burden proof, but you're a little bit naive. He made it very clear in the affidavit, and I say this respectfully, he made it very clear. They told me, sign this on, and that's the way I get out of here. And my response to you, in terms of real-world events, someone who's illiterate, doesn't speak the language, and the one thing someone has indicated to that person, sign the form and you get out of here, they sign the form and they get out. And they may not have shown that here, but I think it's naive to suggest that everything goes as you're suggesting, just clean and orderly, the translator, the judge fully explained everything. That's not the way life works.
I can see that it does not always work that way, Your Honor. Nevertheless, I think that is, in this situation, what the Constitution does not mandate, that the government go out and disprove every possible bad thing that could have gone wrong in a prior proceeding.
We hear you.
What do you make of the line in Park that you can't say it's fundamentally in a fair place, at least a burden of production on the defendant?
Yes. I don't think that the Supreme Court was there saying this is therefore the floor. In other words, anything below that. Because after all, later, as the Court's questions earlier also indicated, the Supreme Court also discussed how there was a multiplicity of practice and mentioned a number of states, a large number of states, which even at the time when Park v. Raley was decided, assigned the full burden of proof to the defendant. And the Supreme Court expressed no disapproval of that practice. They were simply discussing the Kentucky state procedure before the court and were holding that it did not violate due process. They did not say that Kentucky state procedure was therefore the minimum that the Constitution requires. In other words, that therefore the constitutionally mandated minimum is this sort of complex burden of production or burden shifting scheme. And I think, again, you know, every circuit to have addressed this question has held that it is the burden of the defendant to show that a prior conviction was unconstitutionally imposed. And we submit that burden has not been met here.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we respectfully submit that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gilbert, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the only thing I'm going to leave you with, I don't want to add to the gobbledygook about production persuasion, except that I think it is important to understand that the defect in this case that we are alleging is, in fact, the absence of counsel. If the lawyer is standing next to the defendant, as there was in Park, then I think courts can have a greater degree of confidence that the defendant's other ancillary rights are being represented. Now, I know that's not always true, because not every lawyer gets it right every time. But the presence of counsel helps ameliorate and should give courts more confidence that what happened when counsel was there was proper, or else counsel objects and raises the issue. With the absence of counsel altogether, there is a certain perversity, I suggest, in suggesting that a defendant must somehow marshal all of the resources to prove that he didn't waive his right to counsel when he didn't have counsel to help him marshal those resources in the first place.
But should we take into account the fact that the proceeding was one in which he got a good deal? The DUI at a .14 goes in, gets probation for a few months. Does that matter in our calculus? In other words, I'm not sure what counsel would have advised against in getting such a good deal for a .14 DUI.
Well, I'm pretty confident that the courts haven't drawn that distinction.
I'm just wondering, in thinking about whether the waiver was knowing, do we think about what kind of proceeding was going on and whether it would have been illogical to waive? In other words, sometimes we get cases, obviously, where we think, boy, that was a mistake to waive your right to whatever it may be in the case. But here, certainly doesn't seem that kind of proceeding. Now, I don't think that really plays a factor in the analysis, but something I thought about.
Well, let's just answer that briefly, though. This was unusual in the sense that he wasn't driving and stopped, all right? This was a situation where he was in the car, and the car was stopped. Now, I don't know what Georgia law is, and we know that operating a vehicle doesn't have to mean it's moving. But remember, he was also given a citation for the possession of the open container of alcohol. And so, you know, without a lawyer to help him parse through that, it's not so clear to me that he knew that he was guilty of the driving while intoxicated. What they did
that's,
is...
That's a fair point.
So lawyer might have helped in that case. Right. I don't know, Your Honor.
Right.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. You are appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and we thank you for your excellent assistance.
Thank you. It's very great.